Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Satya. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. So if you're familiar with the hand-finger convention from philosophy discussion periods where a hand represents a new line of questioning and a finger is a follow-up, I am allowed to use my finger. And the second ground rule is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. That question is, could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
All right, thank you. I'm Beatrice Longanes. I teach philosophy at NYU. I'm interested in the history of modern philosophy, especially Kant and post-Kantian German philosophy, but actually all philosophy since Kant. And before, but that's my sort of center. And I'm interested in especially issues in the philosophy of mind and language, the first person, and philosophy of psychoanalysis.
It's really great to have you on the podcast. I should say you played a very important part in my philosophical development. I had been someone who was really not interested in the history of philosophy. And then in graduate school, there was about a year-long period when, under your influence, I carried around the Kemp Smith edition of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, the one with the kind of funny colored bullseye. And my then girlfriend, now wife, mocked me for never going anywhere without it until it eventually shredded into fragments. So I'm glad to have the opportunity thank you for that.
Oh wow, that's good to hear.
As you know, this podcast is inspired by Iris Murdoch, and I'm going to start us off with a quote from Murdoch, which is this. She wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time, to attempt to discover the truth." So would you say that your temperament sort of influences your philosophy? And if so, how?
So I think more in terms of circumstances. I think the circumstances in which I found myself, the way I learned philosophy, the place where I learned philosophy have influenced perhaps not so much my philosophy, but the way I did philosophy and the kinds of questions that have interested me. Now, of course, I don't want to push that point too far. Circumstances do also shape a temperament in two ways. The circumstances in which I found myself have developed in me a certain kind of propensities. I'm pretty obsessional. I think actually all academics are pretty obsessional, and perhaps especially philosophers. We sort of sweat the details. I obsess over texts. And I've often noticed that even when I do contemporary philosophy, I sweat over the text. I treat it as a text in history, which is always a strange text where it's not obvious at all what people mean by the concepts they're using. So in that sense, yes, my temperament influence. I don't think I have a philosophy. I have ways of doing philosophy, and I have questions that interest me in philosophy. In that way, I'm like Kant. I would say, is there a philosophy? You can learn to do philosophy, but do you learn a philosophy or do you have a philosophy? I'm not sure. So anyway, and there's another way in which I would say temperament maybe influences the way I do philosophy, not so much in a psychological sense, but in the sense of, you know, what Kant called character, the set of values that shape the sort of map of my mind and the questions I think about. That's how I would put it, yeah. So it's circumstances then, temperament in those two senses, and then from temperament back to circumstances, because then new circumstances arise. That's how it works in my mind.
Could you say a bit about the original circumstances of learning about philosophy that pointed you towards, I take it that's what pointed you towards the obsession with texts and the more historical approach to philosophy in particular?
Right. So I was initially trained in France, of course. So in France, you have philosophy already in high school. And then I did the preparation for the École Normale Supérieure, where there was very intensive philosophy training, but was mostly, you know, focused on studying texts very closely. And then, of course, we did have to write papers about topics. But even writing a paper, an argument-driven paper, was much more rooted in having studied seriously the texts of the history of philosophy than what I was exposed to and actually enjoyed the other way of doing philosophy I enjoyed when I arrived in the US. So that's the initial circumstance. Then when I say circumstances, I don't just mean, although I first mean in the first stage, as it were, the schooling, the way you're schooled, but I also mean, you know, the social surrounding, the kind of questions that I became obsessed with in my obsessional way because of my family situation, because of the history of my parents, because of the relations, the complicated relations between post-war France and post-war Germany. So that played a very major part in the fact that I was interested in that obsessional way in German philosophy. What's been going on there? So yeah, it's circumstances in a very broad sense. Yeah, first, where you come from, and then what kind of areas of concerns in a broad sense you have grown up into.
So having had you explain how obsessed with philosophy you are, I'm actually going to ask my original questions out of order and mm-hmm. switch to this one, which is, so this is now going to be question two. If you weren't a philosopher, what do you think you would do?
Oh, yeah. So I was struck by the fact that in the little, you know, mock interview you gave yourself to give us a sense of what you wanted to do, you said in your case you would be a mailman, but you said, but that's a fantasy. So then I was wondering, so when he asked the question, does he mean in fantasy or does he mean in reality? What would you be? And I think depending on what is meant, I would have two different answers. Am I allowed two different answers?
Absolutely.
Okay, so in fantasy, and that's something I have fantasized a lot about, and I'm still sort of wistfully, because I don't think it will ever happen at this point, fantasizing about it. I would be, you know, somewhere lost in Provence, somewhere in a little house in the middle of nowhere, just reading books and listening to music and, yeah, maybe, you know, teaching. I don't even know even what I would be teaching somewhere, having some honorable, useful, but not too stress-driven job, and then enjoying being in the middle of nowhere. That's my fantasy in the lovely countryside where I was born, actually, in the south of France. The non-fantasy, which was a reality, I mean, it was really at several, and especially I remember one crucial point, a real possibility, was just give up philosophy at the point when I was especially low on why am I doing this in the first place, and do medical studies and do the whole path of medical studies, psychiatry and psychoanalysis, which is something that had always interested me a lot, but I didn't believe in psychoanalysis without understanding the body itself in a very, you know, very basic, fundamental medical way. So, and I, at some point, when I was finishing my PhD on Hegel, of all people, because that's really, you know, the most abstract kind of philosophy you can imagine. And I thought, why am I doing this? And I was on the verge of just stopping it all. And, you know, I had a good income because I was teaching at the same time. And I had a very, very sweet boyfriend who said, yes, if you want to do that, I'll support you. Just start all over, do medical studies, I'll support you. And we were going to do it. And then I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought of all those books I would never read. And I couldn't, so I didn't do it. But it was a real possibility. And I know several philosophers who have the same kinds of interests I have, who told me that they had the same temptation. So I do think there's probably some really deep connection here, although it's a very, very different type of profession and skills that you would need. But yeah, so that was a possibility at some point. But I don't fantasize about it, whereas I do fantasize about my little house in the middle of nowhere and just, you know, doing something useful, low stress, and reading my books. Yeah.
That does sound wonderful. Yeah, I can appreciate the fantasy. Well, so now my next question, I now have some guesses as to how you might answer it, but you can always confirm or surprise them, because the next question, this is number three, may take us back to Hegel or not. The question is, what's your worst moment as a philosopher?
Yeah, actually, it's funny because I hadn't thought of the connection, and I hadn't thought I would tell you the the being in despair over Hegel being the one of the circumstances in which I thought I might go into medical studies instead. But yeah, my worst moment in philosophy, I think, was indeed connected to Hegel. And it was around about the same time, actually. It was maybe slightly later, because at that point I had already finished my PhD, I was already teaching, and I was invited to give a lecture at the École Normale Supérieure. They had, for that national exam called the Agrégation, which, you know, every student who wants to do a career either teaching high school or in academia has to take that exam, which is a pretty competitive, difficult, hard work exam. And they had as the topic on the program for that exam, history. So there's general the types of paper you have to write. And one of the types of paper you have to write, you have a topic, you have to study the whole year, and then you write a paper on an assigned topic in that area. So the topic for the year was history. And there was a lecture series, and I was asked to give a lecture on Hegel, which is, of course, a crucial figure for history. And I had written my dissertation on Hegel's Science of Logic. And that's what really interests me. I had a very, very abstract mind. I think I'm a little bit less abstract, although I'm still pretty abstract, which is not something I like very much, but I am pretty abstract. So anyway, I did Hegel not by doing the philosophy of history, which is a bunch of lectures and they're fun and there's all sorts of little facts. He liked facts. And I tried to explain to my bemused audience that really what you needed to understand Hegel's philosophy of history was his Science of Logic. And I remember I had really worked very hard because I knew in an hour, what can you say? What how can you explain this? And I had lost sleep the previous night, I think knowing I was headed into a car crash. And I start the lecture and it was a full room and lots of them were my friends. They were very well disposed. They were very expectant. Everybody was excited. And after 3 minutes, I could see that I had already lost them. And I had to. It was impossible that it would go otherwise. And I was I was very inexperienced at that time. I think if it happened now, and it could, of course, still happen, I would know to switch gear and, you know, find a way to get the thing under control again. But instead, I just plowed on because I didn't know how to do otherwise. And so I continued this lecture in front of this good-willed audience that was trying so hard to be supportive and just couldn't get on board. It was awful. And I finished, and then people asked questions, again, very good-willed questions, but either I didn't understand the question or the question showed that they just hadn't understood that what I was talking about, or both, probably. And so we finished the question period, and then I stopped. And then one of my colleagues, so there was this big long table because there were several speakers. It was a whole day thing. And one of my colleagues turns to me and he says, I'll give you the French. And then I translate. He said, vous êtes planté. It was not even harsh. It was like a desolate tone. Vous êtes planté. You blew it. You know, it was like that. Uh-huh. You just, yeah. And he wasn't saying as if he was informing me that I had blown it, but just confirming what obviously I knew. Maybe I think that's my worst moment. Yeah.
Was this the kind of experience that you look back on and think, well, I really learned something that was, I feel like that has shaped me in a positive way? Or do you just look back and think, I blew it?
I blew it. I think what I learned from it, I already knew. I think maybe I learned one thing, which is when I knew I would go into a car crash, I was going to a car crash. I should do something else. I think that, but you know, it's happened in less extreme ways, but it's happened again, of course, that I knew something wouldn't work and nevertheless I had to try it and lo and behold, it didn't work. But this was an extreme case and I think I learned to heed the warning more. Yeah, that when I know something is not going to work, generally it's not going to work. Yeah, so that, you know, why it didn't work, that I knew it already. I just shouldn't have done it. It was kind of a self-destructive thing. I don't know.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I blame Hegel, really. I feel like he has a lot to answer for.
Probably. Yes. But then why did I do that? I mean, I remember when I arrived at Princeton, and so I was hired as this, you know, in between I had done a lot of work on Kant, which I thought, you know, in some ways I understood better, in some ways I understood even less. So why do I do this myself again? But I did. So anyway, I was hired to teach Kant, but also to teach Hegel. And I remember a very nice philosopher who became a very good friend, wanting to know what I had done before I did all that work on Kant. And I said, well, I wrote my PhD on Hegel's Science of Logic. And he said, oh, you choose the easy things, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, so this there's a nice segue here, I guess, from your worst moment as a philosopher to question four, which is about your greatest non-philosophical achievement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think my greatest non-philosophical, but it dates really already way back. But since there has been sort of segues, it remains something very dear to me. And it was a real achievement that I'm very happy I was, you know, able to have. But it was a very early on in my life. I was at a young age a really accomplished cellist. I studied at the conservatory. Wow. I spent a lot of time on it. I became really very good. So the reason I say it's way back, you know, I did a lot of music between the age of 7 and the age of 15. And at 15, I was really very, very good. And 16, I was really very, very good. And then I stopped practicing as much because I just didn't have time, since the choice was, no, I'm going to. And that's something also I considered, being a professional musician. But I really liked studying too much. I liked studying even more than I liked doing music. And in France, musical education and academic education are much more separate than they are in the US. I mean, either you did the conservatoire or you went to university. And even more, you went to the École Supérieure if you wanted to be really on the top school. And that wouldn't be compatible with the kind of intensive training you would have. So it was a choice. And so I chose academia over music. And truth be told, I probably wouldn't have had an extraordinary career in music. I just loved it a lot. And so I started doing it less, and I became less good. I mean, you know, it's very, very unforgiving. Musical training. If you don't do it as much, well, you still play, but you don't play the same way. So, but yeah, that I think that was my. But then it's had some follow-ups, which I'm really happy with too. So I continued playing, and I played in all sorts of different contexts. I played orchestra, I played chamber music, and when I arrived at Princeton, I played with Harry Frankfurt. That was my last big phase of playing serious cello. It was playing with Harry Frankfurt, and that it's a non-philosophical achievement, which I was very happy with too.
What does Harry play?
He plays the piano. He's an accomplished pianist. He's an excellent pianist.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I think it's time to ask the final question, the second Iris Murdoch-inspired question. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
So I've thought about that because I have, maybe it's part of my obsessional character. I actually have quite a few fears, but I think what I'm most afraid of and have been, and that's explained centrally by my circumstances again, it's that my life has developed in such a way that I live mostly in the US, but also in France. I have very strong connections, both in terms of friendships, professional connections, memories, older colleagues, very, very dear to me, whom I, you know, really stay in touch with in the United States. But my partner is in France. My siblings are in France. And there's no other way. My life is like that. It's divided in that way. And a major fear I've had for quite a while, and I have more and more as I get older, is so at some point I will have to choose. You can't live forever like that. And my big fear is that I will not get to choose if I don't choose on time, if I don't choose early enough. The choice will be made for me because I will get stuck on one side. And that's a fear I've had for a long time, thinking, yes, but what, you know, if I'm gravely ill and I won't be able to travel anymore or In one way or another, the choice will be made for me rather than me making the choice, of course, in consultation with the people I love and for whom this matters. That's a fear I've had for a long time. And of course, now it's become real. It's become real. So we've been talking about this, but I'm in a state of great anxiety about this whole confinement thing. It's a real thing that, no, I thought I had this free life where I could be wherever I wanted. And then as I grew older, the walls start, you know, closing in. And now they are closed in. And they will open again, but that's the fear. It's that you thought you had a choice about your life, but really at some point your life chooses for you, and you'd better make sure you're in a position that you choose what your life chooses for you or something. That's, yeah. I don't know whether it fits the kinds of fears you were thinking of or that are relevant to what you think a philosopher's fear is, but for me it's a very existential fear, yeah.
Well, yeah, all fears are welcome. I was partly curious about whether people would point to things that are related to their philosophical work or not. I have to admit, embarrassment.
It is related, actually. That's an interesting thing, but go on. It is related.
Well, I was going to say, it only occurred to me, this is a function of compartmentalization, that I thought of doing the podcast as a way to sort of connect with people in a time of lockdown. It only occurred to me when you brought it up that asking people what are they afraid of in the current circumstances might be, these might not be the ideal circumstances to ask people that question, because now everyone is afraid of so much and so justifiably. But
but it's still interesting. It's interesting, I guess. I mean, I would be interested, and I will be interested listening to your podcast. If people bring up the present situation as I have, there will still be ways in which they relate to it, which may be quite different.
I think that's true.
So no, but when you said, I thought people will bring up fears that are related to your work, to their work, or to their identity as a philosopher. Actually, for me, it is the case, because I have. And, you know, that's how I came to the United States in the first place. I was deeply impressed by the way philosophy was done in the United States. That's really what I wanted to do. And that's not what my training had been. And I felt my whole experience in the, you know, various capacities in which I have listened to other people and talked to other people, either as a teacher or as a lecturer or listening to other people's talks or going to workshops, I found it incredibly liberating. And at the same time, contrary to what I had thought when I came, I have not been able to cut the links to my native France. So I still have, because especially my whole family is here, now my partner is here. And my fear actually is that on the one hand, I could decide, okay, I stay in the US, but then I lose all that long history. Or I could decide, I go back to France, and then the fear is even worse, because my adult life and my feeling of intellectual freedom and personal freedom, it's in the US. And that relates to philosophy. My philosophy is a philosophy that is both deeply rooted in the kind of training I've had in France, and that is entirely shaped today by what I've done in the United States. And the two, in some way, the two have merged, but they have not entirely merged. I think I have a split identity. And thinking how this is going to play out has not always been as strong a factor of anxiety as it is now, but now it is a factor of anxiety. Yeah. So it's a fear. It's a real fear. Yeah. And there's other fears that are less selfish. The other fear is, and I guess it's also related to how I think about philosophy, we are entering a completely new world on the other side of, you know, the lockdown, which is a world in which old people like me, not you, you're much younger, you are my student, are real. I feel we are weighing on the future of this. They need to take a new start. They need to find new solutions. And first, they have to deal with this huge elderly population that is much wealthier than them and nevertheless much more vulnerable than they are, and that are preventing them from just, you know, spreading their wings. And it's true in all ways. It's true practically. It's also true philosophically. I feel I'm less astute, agile than the younger part of the profession. I think I'm not the only one. And I think we need to think very seriously about, okay, so now, how do we allow the discipline of philosophy to reshape itself, to breathe? And that's, yeah, so that's again a kind of cosmic fear that also seeps into the way I think about philosophy.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your fears and anxieties and your divided identity. It's been wonderful to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been quite an experience.
Thanks again. That was Beatrice Longines. She's professor of philosophy at NYU. Among her recent books are I, Me, Mine, Back to Kant and Back Again, and The First Person in Cognition and Morality. I hope you'll join me next time for another 5 questions.